quite well read as a boy. His low grades as a student cannot be credited to a poor intellect. Rather, I assume they were attributable to his immaturity and the insecurity he must have felt as an undersized youth in a rough-and-tumble world that had humbled many older, bigger men. "I went in there at the age of 16," he once told an interviewer, "and I weighed 105 pounds. I could barely carry a Springfield rifle." Even as an upperclassman, my father struggled to meet the robust physical standards imposed on midshipmen. My father's roommates, two of whom were linemen on the varsity football team, treated him like a little brother and went to great lengths to protect him. They helped him through the relentless hazing of his plebe year, took the blame when they could for his infractions of academy regulations, and made it clear that they would deal with any midshipman who thought to abuse him. As hard as they tried, my father's friends could not spare him the consequences of his own natural rebelliousness. His report cards list a staggering number of demerits for bad conduct. "I, too, was a notoriously undisciplined midshipman, and the demerits I received were almost enough to warrant my expulsion. But I never racked them up as prodigiously as my father had. Typically, he found some value in his troublemaking and in the punishment he earned for it. You get to know people that you don't ordinarily know if you're one of the good boys, and sometimes the world's not always made up of all the good boys either, not by a long shot," he said. The memory of his frequent clashes with its regulations and authorities never diminished my father's abiding reverence for the Academy's traditions and purpose. He remained until the end of his life one of the Academy's most steadfast defenders. My father suffered a serious disappointment his last year at Annapolis. In the same year that my grandfather was earning his naval aviator wings, my father was judged, quote, "not physically qualified for aviation school." I suspect this was a hard blow. His lifelong ambition was to emulate the man he most admired, and being deprived of this opportunity to follow in the old man's footsteps must have shaken his resolve considerably. After graduating, barely, standing 18th from the bottom, my father was assigned to the Oklahoma. As he would throughout his career, he made the most of his opportunity. His father's career guidance to him had been limited to impressing on his son the importance of command. "It doesn't make any difference where you go," his father often said. "You've got to command." With that in mind, my father entered the submarine service after his tour on the Oklahoma. His father approved of the decision and told him to make a good job of it, which my father did in his relentless pursuit of a command. I hesitate to write that my father was insecure, but he was thrust into difficult circumstances at such a young age that it would have been very hard to resist some self-doubt. Nevertheless, he would succeed and become the Navy's first son of a 4-star admiral to reach the same rank as his father. The Navy consumed nearly his every thought. He had few aspirations for success outside its narrow confines. Whatever other interests engaged his mind were in some way associated with the Navy. He attended every Army-Navy football game he could, not because he loved football, but because it involved the Navy. It could have been the Army-Navy Tiddlywinks Championship, and he still would have wanted to attend it. He did not fish or hunt or share his father's fondness for gambling or my enthusiasm for sports. He played tennis often and kept to a daily regimen of rope jumping and sit-ups, not because he particularly enjoyed exercise, but because he intended to keep himself fit for combat command. He worked ceaselessly. Lacking the gregariousness and easy charm of his father, he was less comfortable in social situations, a failing that can be an obstacle to any officer's advancement. My mother was indispensable to my father. She acquired an abiding affection for the whole of the culture, once remarking that she was tailor-made for the Navy. Her vivacious charm, beauty, and refinement assured her success in the social aspect of Navy life and more than compensated for my father's weaker possession of those graces. Most families of naval officers lived on modest resources, a condition attributable to the meager salaries paid to officers in those days. Although my mother came from a wealthy family, our family lived, in accordance with my father's wish, on his income alone. Yet we never wanted for anything, and we believed we lived within a privileged society where refined manners made the relative poverty that most families shared inconspicuous. More than the manners of polite society distinguished the life of a naval officer. His character was expected to be above reproach, his life a full testament to the enduring virtues of an officer and a gentleman. An officer's honor could admit some vices, and many officers, my father and grandfather included, indulged in more than a few. But honor would not permit even rare or small transgressions of the code of conduct that was expected to be as natural a part of an officer's life as was his physical description. An officer must not lie, steal, or cheat, ever. He keeps his word, whatever the cost. He must not shirk his duties, no matter how difficult or dangerous they are. His life is ransomed to his duty. An officer must trust his fellow officers and expect their trust in return. He must not expect others to bear what he will not. An officer's obligations to enlisted men are the most solemn of all. My father once said, "Some officers get it backwards. They don't understand that we are responsible for our men, not the other way around." That's what forges trust and loyalty. This was the Navy in which my father and grandfather felt so at home. They had entered its ranks already imbued with the notions of honor that distinguished a good officer. My brother once said, "I have never met a more honest man than my father. I literally cannot think of a single time he did not tell the truth about something as best he knew it." Happy in his profession, my father worked every day without exception. On Christmas morning, after we had opened our presents in front of the Christmas tree, he would excuse himself, change into his uniform, and leave for his office. I cannot recall a single instance when he came home from work earlier than 8 o'clock in the evening. As any other child would, I resented my father's absences, interpreting them as a sign that he loved his work more than his children. This was unfair of me, and I regret having felt that way. The most important relationship in my father's life had been his bond with my grandfather. That cherished bond influenced every major decision my father made throughout his life. Yet my grandfather had been absent from his family at least as often as my father was away from us, probably more often. He had done his duty as his country had asked him to, and his family understood and admired him for it. My father was devout, although the demands of his profession sometimes made regular church going difficult. My father didn't talk about God, but he always kept with him a tattered, dog-eared prayer book from which he would pray aloud for an hour on his knees twice every day. He drank too much, which did not become him, and I often felt that my father's religious devotion was intended in part to help him control his drinking. In the Navy in which my father came of age, men relaxed by drinking. The greater the burdens a man bore, the more he drank to relieve himself of them. During the Second World War, when exhausted submarine crews finished a combat patrol in the Pacific, which typically lasted from 6 weeks to 2 months, they would come into port at Midway Island or Fremantle, Australia, for a month's rest camp. These remote locations offered few natural or cultural distractions from the terrors of war. In Fremantle, the Navy rented houses for the men and stocked them with cases of beer and liquor. The men, most of them kids in their teens and twenties, lacking anything better to do, would drink themselves senseless until their next patrol. There was one rule about drinking that most submariners, my father included, considered inviolate. A submariner never drank aboard ship. Submarine warfare is as treacherous and mentally exacting as any form of warfare can be. It requires the combatants to be in full possession of their faculties at all times while underway. Accordingly, no matter how excessive their binge drinking was when ashore, my father and his crew stayed sober at sea. My father returned from war with a great appetite for drink, which he overindulged until the very last years of his life. He was never completely incapacitated by his weakness. but when he was drunk, I did not recognize him. On occasions, friends cautioned him that his drinking was harming his career, but he never let it get so out of hand that it ruined his fitness for command. Like his father, my father swore a lot, and subordinates often referred to him as "Good Goddamn McCain." Also like his father, he was a chain smoker, although he preferred enormous cigars to my grandfather's roll-your-own cigarettes. My father developed his sea power lecture in mid-career when he served as the Navy's first chief of information and later as the Navy's senior liaison officer to the United States Congress. Both posts helped to broaden his circle of acquaintances outside the Navy. He became a frequent witness before congressional committees. He acquired some of the skills of an accomplished military historian who moonlighted as a stage actor. Appreciative audiences gave him the nickname Mr. Sea Power. My parents kept a house on Capitol Hill, where they entertained leading political and military figures. My mother's charm proved as effective with politicians as it was with naval officers. The political relationships my parents forged during this period contributed significantly to my father's future success. Among their friends was Carl Vinson, chairman of the House Armed Forces Committee. My father was not, however, a political admiral, a term of derision accorded to successful officers whose records lacked combat experiences comparable to those of the warfighters who disapproved of them. He was, as his father had been, a man of strong views who spoke his mind bluntly. This is as risky a habit in Navy politics as it is in civilian politics, and it often caused him trouble. Both McCain Sr. and Jr. believed war to be a ruthless endeavor, the purpose of which was to annihilate your enemy. My grandfather's frequent insulting references to the personal qualities of the Japanese enemy were in accord with the conventions of the time, although when I read them today, I wince at their racist overtones. I don't believe they were intended as racist screeds. My grandfather, as combatants often do, needed to work up a powerful hate for his enemy. Hate sustains the fighter in his devotion to the complete destruction of his enemy. My father rose to high command when communism had replaced fascism as the dominant threat to American security. He hated it fiercely. He believed that one side or the other would ultimately win total victory, and sea power would prove critical to the outcome. He was outspoken on the subject. When he attained commands that required diplomatic skills, his candor occasionally lacked the rhetorical courtesies that attended the first attempts at détente. This often caused anxiety in the State Department, but it won him admirers, despite the prominent anti-war sentiment in 1960s America. Addressing the Naval Academy class of 1970, he commented on the popular anti-war slogan, "Make love, not war," that naval officers were men enough to do both. Few successful naval officers crest the heights of command without making enemies as well as friends along the way. My grandfather and father had their detractors in the Navy, some of whom may have disliked their highly personalized style of leadership, others their grasping ambition. But they were well respected by most of their fellow officers as resourceful, resilient, and brave commanders. It was, however, the regard in which they were held by the enlisted men who served under them that gave them the greatest satisfaction. They both had great empathy for the ranks and went out of their way to show it. To some of his most senior subordinates, my father could be a difficult and demanding boss. He kept his own counsel and would sometimes leave his subordinates in the dark about matters that directly concerned them. A few of them felt, perhaps with cause, that he did not treat them fairly. But his closest aides loved him. And he was almost universally revered by those whose rank was the farthest beneath his own. They knew he held them in high esteem, and they returned the compliment. To this day, several times a year, I receive letters from men who once served in the ranks under my father's or grandfather's command. Some are from aides who closely observed them for long periods of time under conditions of great stress. I value these testimonials as much as my father and grandfather did. They are from men who at one time risked death at the order of the John McCain they wrote to praise. The day the Japanese sank the fleet in Pearl Harbor is one of my earliest memories. I was 5 years old. We were living in New London at the time. My father left for the base immediately. I saw very little of him for the next 4 years. He commanded 3 submarines during the war. The first command he held just briefly before being ordered on his first combat patrol. The second, the USS Gunnell, served as a reconnaissance and beacon ship for Operation Torch, the American invasion of North Africa. The Gunnell was ordered to leave New London at midnight on October 18 and proceed to waters off Fadala, French Morocco, about 15 miles north of Casablanca, arriving there 5 days in advance of the invasion. Under strict orders to remain undetected at all costs, the Gunnell was to make landfall submerged, a dangerous and exacting maneuver, and once there, to reconnoiter and photograph the beaches to determine the best landing sites. By means of infrared searchlights invisible to the unaided eye, the Gunnell served as a lighthouse for the invading armada, keeping the ships on course for the landing beaches. An hour before midnight on November 7th, the Gunnell signalman sighted the huge fleet cresting the horizon exactly on schedule. The Gunnell began flashing its designated signal, and throughout the night, American ships took up their positions off the Moroccan coast and lowered their landing craft. At dawn, the Gunnell's secret mission complete, my father was ordered to fly the American flag, illuminate it with a spotlight, and proceed on the surface at top speed out of the congested area to safer waters near the Canary Islands. Friendly fire, a misfortune of war today, was a much more frequent occurrence in earlier wars. On their passage out of the invasion area, my father allowed his crew to stand topside in shifts to watch the naval barrage directed at the fortifications at Fadala and Casablanca. As my father and some of his crew stood mesmerized, watching the spectacular assault, the booming guns of American battleships firing one-ton shells toward the outgunned enemy, an American P-40 plane dropped out of the clouds and began strafing the Gunnell. My father ordered the sub to dive, and he and the other men on deck scrambled down the conning tower hatch, the entrance to the submarine's interior. 15 minutes later, the Gunnell surfaced and was signaled by an American seaplane. "Good morning, Sallow Face. I am here to protect you." The plane escorted the Gunnell to safety for some time until it broke off to chase an approaching French plane away from the sub. When the Gunnell reached its assigned station and patrolled waters off the Canaries, it was hunted for 4 days by German subs. On November 13th, my father was ordered to make for a British submarine base at Roseneath, Scotland. En route 3 days later, the Gunnell was spotted and chased by a U-boat. Later that same day, one of the Gunnell's 4 main engines broke down. Over the next 9 days, the 3 remaining main engines stopped working. When the last of its 4 engines gave out, the Gunnell was still 1,000 miles from Scotland and sailing in extremely hazardous waters, infested with German subs and patrolled by German aircraft. My father ordered his engineers to convert the auxiliary engine, normally used to power the sub's lights and air conditioning, for propulsion. Upon completion of his first combat mission, the 31-year-old submarine skipper was commended by the Atlantic Fleet Commander-in-Chief. Quote, "Commander John S. McCain, by extremely skillful and daring handling of his ship, performed special missions which contributed materially to the successful execution of an extremely difficult landing of a large expeditionary force on a strange and poorly charted coast." Although he had initially wanted to be an aviator, in later years my father would remark that his disqualification as a pilot had been a lucky twist of fate. He was proud to be a skipper in a service that was then, and is now, a select branch of the Navy. The officers and crew of the Gunnell called him Captain Jack. In the words of his executive officer and friend of many years, retired Rear Admiral Joe Vasey, the men of the USS Gunnell, quote, "would do anything for their skipper." My father daily wandered through the submarine's compartments, greeting and joking with his subordinates. He paused here and there to have a cup of coffee with the men and to have them bring him up to date on the details of their lives back home. There were 8 officers and 72 enlisted men on board the Gunnell. My father knew the first names of every one of them. He knew who was married and how many kids they had. He knew what sports they favored and what they had done for a living before the war. After the war, when any one of them contacted him for assistance, he did all he could to provide it. Admiral Vasey, who worked for my father again when he reached the pinnacle of his career as Commander-in-Chief Pacific, calls him the greatest leader of men I have ever known. Patrolling the waters between Midway and Nagasaki on their second combat patrol, the crew of the gunwale had their greatest success under my father's command, as well as their first encounter with Japanese depth charges, one of the most harrowing experiences in naval warfare. In the early evening of June 18th, while hunting on the surface in the East China Sea just south of the Korean Peninsula, the gunwale sighted the masts and smokestacks of seven large Japanese freighters and two smaller vessels. The smaller boats, one a fishing trawler and the other probably a small destroyer, were serving as escorts. The ships were making full speed and changing course by 40 to 60 degrees every 10 minutes. By plotting their base course, the gunwale's navigation officer determined that the convoy was heading for Shanghai. Unable to close with a fast-moving convoy while his submarine was submerged and making a top speed of only 9 knots, my father decided to surface and, traveling at 17 knots, get ahead of the convoy during the night. Around 5:30 the morning of the 19th, the sub's radar picked up an enemy plane patrolling 8 miles away. My father gave the order to submerge. When the gunwale surfaced an hour later, the convoy was on the horizon, now steaming slowly. The gunwale dove again and proceeded to close with the enemy at full speed. An hour and a half later, the gunwale was within firing range of the freighters. My father fired 3 torpedoes from his bow tubes at the nearest ship, an old freighter of about 8,000 tons. A minute later, he fired 3 more from the bow at a second freighter. The first freighter was hit, and it sank within a few minutes, while the gunwale reached for the bottom. At 80 feet, the men of the gunwale heard another torpedo explode. It had missed the second freighter, but it struck a third ship 2,000 yards on the port side of the intended target. A moment later, one of the convoy's 2 escort ships dropped the first of 7 depth charges, each one detonating closer than the preceding one. Joe Vasey described what it was like to be depth charged. It was like being in a steel container with someone hitting a giant sledgehammer against it. It can shake the whole bloody sub. Submarine crewmen prepared by bending their legs to absorb the impact. As Joe Vasey explained, many a submariner had fractured legs from the shock of the deck plates and standing too rigidly. The gunwale had submerged 150 feet when the last of the 7 depth charges exploded. One of the escorts, probably the trawler, was directly overhead. It dropped a grapnel over the side to try to hook the sub, a favorite tactic of commercial fishing vessels that were pressed into war service. The grapnel's chain dragged along the port side of the gunwale, rattling slowly and excruciatingly, my father recorded in his log, adding that the chains of Marley's ghost sounded very much like that to old Scrooge. My father ordered the gunwale to descend to a depth of 300 feet. The sub ran at that depth for 4 hours. Twice my father heard the enemy escort pass directly overhead. After an hour had passed without hearing anything from the enemy ship that was searching, its depth charges ready for the gunwale, my father came up to periscope depth. He sighted a Japanese warship about 3,000 yards to his starboard and immediately submerged again to 300 feet. A large Japanese naval base was located at Sasebo, less than 100 miles to the east of the gunwale's position. In response to the gunwale's attack on the convoy, 3 destroyers had been sent out of Sasebo to hunt down and destroy the American sub. The approaching ship was one of them. The air was growing foul and the crew's nerves were strained to the breaking point. Around 9 o'clock that night, the gunwale, its batteries dangerously low and its air banks nearly depleted, surfaced. The weary and frightened crew gasped clean air for the first time in 16 hours. It was a cloudless night with bright moonlight and calm seas. At 9:30, A lookout spotted one of the Japanese destroyers 5,800 yards away. My father put the destroyer astern of the sub and gave the order for battle stations. He ordered every man off the bridge, except for the quartermaster and himself, and told the crew to make ready two of the stern torpedo tubes. He ran the gunwale at full speed, making 18 knots, but the destroyer made 30 knots and closed rapidly. At a little less than 3,000 yards, the destroyer's guns opened up on the gunwale, firing fused projectiles that passed over and on either side of the sub. My father had ordered Joe Vasey, the gunwale's torpedo officer, to work out a firing solution for all four of the stern torpedo tubes. With shells fired from the destroyer's guns, quote, getting uncomfortably close, exploding overhead, and missing barely to the gunwale's port and starboard sides, my father yelled, "God damn it, shoot, Joe, shoot!" Vasey fired the two operable torpedoes down the throat of the destroyer as my father sounded the diving alarm. When the gunwale reached 35 feet, the first torpedo hit the destroyer. A few seconds later, five depth charges detonated simultaneously off the gunwale's stern. My father recorded the moment in his log, breaking his usual habit of restricting his official record to a dry recitation of the facts and avoiding dramatic embellishment. The awesome sounds of exploding depth charges and collapsing bulkheads as the warship rapidly sank close astern of gunwale was an unforgettable experience for all hands. My father leveled the sub off at 200 feet. When he picked up the two remaining destroyers on his sonar, rapidly approaching, he took the gunwale down to 300 feet and commenced evasive tactics. The destroyers dropped eight more depth charges off the sub's stern. After 6 hours, the gunwale surfaced very briefly to charge its batteries and airbanks. Spotting the destroyers, my father took it down again. He remained submerged for the next 18 hours, with all auxiliary engines turned off, keeping the sub's noise at a minimum to avoid detection by sonar. The air became so foul that crew members not needed at battle stations were ordered to rest in their bunks, where they would consume less oxygen. Fear and poor air made a few men delirious, and one of them had to be strapped down. The temperature inside the sub had reached 120 degrees. The humidity was 100%. At 8:30 that night, my father called all his officers to the wardroom. The batteries would last only 30 to 60 minutes more, and all the sub's good air was gone. The gunwale would have to surface as quickly as possible. After receiving this discouraging report, my father informed his officers of his intentions. The sub would surface slowly to reduce the likelihood that the blowing of its ballast tanks would be detected by the enemy's sonar. As soon as it surfaced, the ship's guns would be immediately manned and readied for battle. If either of the destroyers was in range, the gunwale would shoot it out and charge its batteries and airbanks on the run. My father offered one other course of action to his officers, a course he strongly opposed. If his officers did not unanimously concur with his decision to fight, he would order all classified information and materials destroyed, surface the sub, and scuttle her. All hands would jump overboard and hope for rescue, a remote hope at best, given that the Japanese skippers, whom they would rely on for rescue, were undoubtedly bent on vengeance and unlikely to be sympathetic. To a man, my father's officers shouted their preference for a fight. When they surfaced, they sighted the destroyers at a considerable distance and steaming away from the gunwale. They gave no indication that they spotted the sub. My father reversed course and hurried away. The batteries for two of his diesel engines were recharged, and fresh air filled the ship. 10 days after my father's submarine eluded the destroyers, it reached Midway. My father received the Silver Star for this action. The citation praised his conspicuous gallantry, bravery under fire, and aggressive fighting spirit. After five combat patrols aboard the gunwale, my father, now Commander McCain, took command of the USS Dintuda, which completed one patrol in the South China Sea before the war's end. During its only patrol, the Dintuda fought a gun battle with two Japanese patrol craft and an inconclusive submerged battle with a Japanese submarine. It was as commander of the Dentuda that my father entered Tokyo Bay, exhausted from the strain of command in one of the more terrifying forms of combat, to enjoy his last reunion with the father whose example had led him to this life. In 1965, my father reported for duty in New York to serve as vice chairman of the delegation to the United Nations Military Staff Committee and as commander of the Eastern Sea Frontier and the Atlantic Reserve Fleet. He had distinguished himself in other commands since the Second World War and had enjoyed a notably successful career. In 1965, violent clashes between warring factions, one of which was believed to be a communist front, had brought the Dominican Republic to the verge of civil war. President Johnson ordered my father to command the amphibious assault of Operation Steel Pike I, the invasion and military occupation of the Caribbean nation. The operation was controversial. Critics judged it, with good reason, to be an unlawful intervention in the affairs of a sovereign nation. My father, typically, was undeterred by domestic opposition. Some people condemned this as an unwarranted intervention, he observed, but the communists were all set to move in and take over. People may not love you for being strong when you have to be, but they respect you for it and learn to behave themselves when you are. The operation was a success, and at the time, it constituted the largest amphibious operation ever undertaken in peacetime. His subsequent assignment at the United Nations, however, was regarded by the Navy as a dead end and was expected to be his last. He was a 3-star admiral, and the prospects for a 4th star were remote. But 2 years later, he was ordered to London to assume command of all U.S. naval forces in Europe. A 4th star came with the job. He relieved the renowned Admiral John Thatch, my grandfather's old operations officer and friend. Within a year, he was given command of all U.S. forces in the Pacific, the largest operational military command in the world. The dominion of the Commander-in-Chief Pacific Command, CINC-PAC, is geographically immense, encompassing 85 million square miles, extending from the Aleutian Islands to the South Pole, and from the west coast of North and South America to the Indian Ocean. CINC-PAC, Admiral Nimitz's wartime command, remains the U.S. Navy's 2nd most prestigious office. Only the office of Chief of Naval Operations is a greater privilege, and if truth be told, a good many officers would prefer running the Pacific Command to running the entire Navy. My father had achieved prominence in his beloved Navy that surpassed his father's storied career. The Washington Post reported his triumph under the headline, "Navy Cheers Appointment of McCain." Over 1 million soldiers, sailors, and airmen now answered to my father's orders. As CINC-PAC, my father had command over the war in Vietnam. General Creighton Abrams, then commanding U.S. forces in Vietnam, was his subordinate, as was I, a lieutenant commander, held as a prisoner of war in Hanoi. I was not quite 2 years old when my parents felt it necessary to instill in me a little self-restraint. I had quite unexpectedly developed an outsized temper that I expressed in an unusual way. At the smallest provocation, I would go off in a mad frenzy and then, suddenly, crash to the floor unconscious. Alarmed at this odd behavior, my parents consulted a Navy physician for an explanation. The doctor assured them that the malady was not serious. It was self-induced. When I got angry, I held my breath until I blacked out. The doctor prescribed a treatment that seems a little severe by modern standards of child care. He instructed my parents to fill a bathtub with cold water whenever I commenced a tantrum, and when I appeared to be holding my breath, to drop me, fully clothed, into it. I do not recall at all these traumatic early encounters, but my mother assures me that they occurred and went on for some time until I was finally cured. My mother often despaired over the quality of her children's education. The frequent relocations imposed on Navy families were the chief obstacle to a decent education. As soon as I had begun to settle into a school, my father would be reassigned. I was often required in a new school to study things I had already learned, Other times, the curriculum assumed knowledge I had not yet acquired. Many of the base schools I attended were substandard institutions. My mother's complaint notwithstanding, I enjoyed my early education. I enjoyed it for the very quality that caused my parents to despair, its informality. Until I was sent at 15 to a boarding school, I relied on the members of my family to be my principal instructors. My mother assumed most of this responsibility, and she proved to be an imaginative and amusing educator. She was forever routing our journeys through locations that offered a site of historical significance or a notable institute of the arts or sciences. They were all memorable events in my childhood, and I recall them today with gratitude. I became my mother's son. What I lacked of her charm and grace, I made up for by emulating and exaggerating other of her characteristics. She was loquacious, and I was boisterous. Her exuberance became rowdiness in me. She taught me to find so much pleasure in life that misfortune could not rob me of the joy of living. She has an irrepressible spirit that yields to no adversity, and that part of her spirit she shared with us was as fine a gift as any mother ever gave her children. My father was a more learned man than his grades at the Naval Academy indicated. He taught physics at the Academy for 2 years and was regarded as an able instructor. My paternal grandmother was a well-educated woman of gifted intellect and refined manner. She had been an instructor of Latin and Greek at the University of Mississippi, where she taught my grandfather. Bookish and 8 years his senior, she won the devotion of the much coarser but widely read naval officer. Throughout their union, they indulged together their shared love of literature, reading aloud to each other whenever time allowed. It was while I was in my grandmother's care that I began to develop my own interest in literature. I spent the summer of 1946 with my widowed grandmother and her daughter, my Aunt Catherine, at their house in Coronado. The room I occupied in my grandmother's house was furnished with my father's boyhood belongings. It contained a substantial collection of the authors he had favored as a boy. I spent most of the summer reading one volume after another. Among the authors who most impressed me in that summer of unsupervised study were Mark Twain, Robert Louis Stevenson, James Fenimore Cooper, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and Booth Tarkington. I was also taken with the tales of King Arthur's court. These works instilled in me a lifelong love of reading, and with their straightforward moral lessons, they reinforced my sense of right and wrong and impressed upon me the virtue of treating people fairly. Like my father and grandfather, I lacked as a boy the physical size to appear imposing on first acquaintance. Together with the challenges of my transient childhood, my small stature motivated me to prove quickly to new schoolmates that I could stand up for myself. The quickest way to do so was to fight the first kid who provoked me. I foolishly believed that fighting, as well as challenging school authorities and ignoring school regulations, was indispensable to my self-esteem and helped me to form new friendships. The repeated farewells to friends rank among the saddest regrets of a childhood constantly disrupted by the demands of my father's career. At each new school, I arrived eager to make, by means of my insolent attitude, new friends to compensate for the loss of others. At each new school, I grew more determined to assert my crude individualism. At each new school, I became a more unrepentant pain in the neck. These are the attitudes I brought to Episcopal High School in Alexandria, Virginia, when I enrolled there, class of 54. My parents had resolved to put an end to our haphazard education and arranged for my sister, my brother, and me to attend private boarding schools. I was sent to Episcopal to prepare for my unavoidable appointment to the United States Naval Academy 3 years later. EHS was not a military academy, but it borrowed a few traditions from Southern service academies. Like the Virginia Military Institute and the Citadel, Episcopal imposed on first-year students the designation RATS. RATS were expected to submit to a comparatively mild form of hazing. Mild or not, I resented the hell out of it. And my resentment, along with my affected disregard for rules and school authorities, soon earned me the distinction of worst rat. My hazing increased to correspond to the disrespect with which I treated school customs. My initial entry into EHS society was rough. I was one of the smaller boys in my class, a fact that upperclassmen, annoyed by my obdurate refusal to show a rat's humility, took to be further evidence of arrogance on my part. These circumstances might have made for a lonely 3 years, but I managed to make friends and find a place for myself. I was good at sports, and athletics were my passage through my difficult first weeks at the school. I played football in the fall, I wrestled in the winter, I played tennis in the spring. I wasn't an exceptional athlete, but I was good enough to earn the respect of my teammates and coaches. Eventually, I would use my reputation both as a credible athlete and as a troublemaker to earn a modest distinction as a leader of sorts at Episcopal. I was often accused of being an indifferent student, and given some of my grades, I can appreciate the charity in that remark. But I was not so much indifferent as selective. I liked English and history, and I usually did well in those classes. I was less interested and less successful in math and science. My grades at Episcopal were divided along those lines. I graduated a member in adequate, if not good, standing of the class of 1954. One of my closest friends at the school, Reeves Ritchie, said later, "If they'd rated everybody in the class for likely to succeed, I guarantee you he'd have been in the bottom 10 without any question." A few months prior to graduation, I had taken the Naval Academy entrance exams and did surprisingly well, even in the math exam. At graduation, there was no longer even the slightest doubt that I would follow my father and my grandfather to Annapolis. And on June 28th, my father drove me to the academy to begin my plebe summer. In those days, an officer escorting his son to the Naval Academy was thought to be an event charged with symbolic importance, a solemn rite of passage. Yet I don't remember it so. I had so long expected the day, so often envisioned the drive, that the actual event seemed more familiar than remarkable. To my surprise, I liked it at first. During plebe summer, academy life had been sort of a highly organized camp, sports, pleasant company, and compared to what awaited us after Labor Day, rather benign leadership from the few upperclassmen and junior officers who supervised us. I made friends easily. I boxed, wrestled, ran the obstacle course, and marched in formation. I did well enough in all of these activities that I briefly showed an enthusiasm for the place that my superiors mistook for an indication that I was an emerging class leader. They made me a company commander that summer. It was one of the very few occasions when I distinguished myself in a positive way at the academy. Coming out of plebe summer, I had, in academy parlance, good grease, which meant I showed a natural aptitude for the service and possessed embryonic leadership qualities. The grease would last about a week past summer's end. In this well-ordered, timeless world, with its lofty aspirations and grim determination to make leaders and gentlemen of schoolboys, plebes who possessed minor eccentricities might be tolerated somewhat. But arrogant nonconformists encountered open hostility. Recognized as belonging in the latter category, I soon found myself in conflict with the academy's authorities and traditions. Instead of beginning a crash course in self-improvement so that I could find a respectable place in the ranks, I reverted to form and embarked on a 4-year course of insubordination and rebellion. Once the second and first classes returned, the unexpected happiness I had experienced in my first weeks at Annapolis rapidly disappeared in the strain of surviving the organized torment that is plebe year. From that moment on, I hated the place, and in fairness, the place wasn't all that fond of me either. Now, more than 40 years after my graduation from the Naval Academy, I understand the premise that supported the harsh treatment of plebes. I may have even grasped it at the time I experienced it, but was simply reluctant to accept its consequences personally. Service academies are not just colleges with a uniform dress code. Their purpose is to prepare you for one profession alone, and that profession's ultimate aspiration is a combat command. The academy experience is intended to determine whether you are fit for such work, and if you are, to mold your natural ability into the attributes of a capable officer. If you aren't, the Academy wants to discover your inaptitude as quickly as possible. The period of discovery is your plebe year, when you are subjected to as much stress as the law in a civilized society will allow. The agents of the Academy's will are the upperclassmen, most of whom relish the assignment. One quarter of the plebes who entered the Academy with me had decided or were told to find another line of work by the time our class graduated. Most of them left during our plebe year. Upperclassmen had driven them out. Of course, nothing in peacetime can replicate the dire experiences of war, but the Academy gives it a hell of a try. The workload imposed on you by instructors is daunting, but by itself is probably not enough to break all but the least determined plebe. It is the physical and mental hazing by upperclassmen that makes the strain of plebe year so excruciating. It seems mindless and unrelenting. I dislike even the memory of it, but, like most graduates of the Academy, my hate for the experience does not constitute regret. It rests in memory, paradoxically, with my appreciation, gratitude really, for the privilege of surviving it, and for the honor of that accomplishment. At moments of great stress, your senses are at their most acute. Your mind works at a greatly accelerated pace. That's the purpose, I take it, of plebe year. Not simply to test your endurance, but to show that you can function exceptionally well, as a leader must function, in concentrated misery. I began to glimpse this truth about midway through my plebe year when added to contempt for imperious upperclassmen was my burgeoning pride in not succumbing to their design to see me bilge out. I resisted not by refusing the hazing, but by letting my resentment show and by failing to conform fully to the convention of a squared-away midshipman. A civilian observer might have judged my appearance to be as neat as that of any other midshipman, but by the exacting standards of the Academy, I was a slob. My ritual obedience to an upperclassman's commands was perfunctory. These are small rebellions, to be sure, but they were noted, and I was pleased that they were. Although my friends and I see that the treatment we received from upperclassmen, our main nemesis was our company officer, Captain Ben Hart, false name, a red-faced, muscular, bull-necked Marine who had played on the Academy football team some years earlier. He was probably in his late 20s, although he seemed much older to us. He was tightly wound, the kind of guy who never appeared relaxed. I don't think he possessed even an anemic sense of humor. Hart wasn't highly regarded by the other officers at the Academy, but he was fiercely determined to command respect from his subordinates. He intended to bring any miscreant in his company quickly to heel. I was one of the miscreants he had in mind. A group of midshipmen who shared a common conceit that we were rebels against the established order had formed a small club and anointed ourselves the Bad Bunch. My roommates, Frank Gamboa, Jack Dittrich, and I were the chief instigators of the group's mischief, but membership often included a few conspicuously squared-away midshipmen. Chuck Larson, one of my best friends at the Academy, was a member who joined in many of our misadventures. We managed to defy most of the rules without committing any breach of the honor code. Failing to apprehend us in the commission of a serious offense, but aware of the notoriety we enjoyed in our class, Captain Hart scrupulously called us to account for smaller infractions of Academy regulations and punished us more severely than required. A combination of academic performance and grease grade determined a midshipman's class standing. The company commander assigned your grease grade. Hart considered my aptitude for the service to be the poorest in the company. In fact, by Hart's reckoning, I possessed no aptitude at all. He never failed to give me the low grease, which, combined with my spotty academic record, always kept me somewhere near the very bottom of the class standings. I must take most of the responsibility for my poor relationship with my company commander. We were a poor match from the start. Hart was a meticulous, by-the-book junior officer who was unfailingly deferential to his superiors, and I was an arrogant, undisciplined, insolent midshipman who felt it necessary to prove my mettle by challenging his authority. In short, I acted like a jerk and gave Hart good cause to despise me. Every company commander was obliged to host the members of his company in their last year, inviting them in small groups to dine at his quarters. The implicit purpose of the custom was to provide us with a little practical training in the social graces before we began our careers as officers, who would be expected to know our salad fork from our soup spoon. Accordingly, the three of us, Frank, Jack, and I, and our other more respectable roommate, Keith Bunning, were invited to join Captain and Mrs. Hart for dinner on a pleasant spring evening in 1958. We anticipated the experience with a mixture of amusement and dread. Before the event, we laughed while conjuring up the image of our earnest company commander temporarily suspending his blind hatred of us to help us grasp the rudiments of gentlemanly deportment, fussing over deficiencies in our table manners, noting whether we paid the lady of the house the proper amount of formal deference, weakly attempting clever repartee, raising his glass aloft and booming, "Gentlemen, the Academy," or "the Corps." As it turned out, at the appointed hour, Captain Hart picked us up at Bancroft Hall and drove us in silence to his home, where we presumed Mrs. Hart awaited our presence at her table. When we arrived at his quarters, we naturally headed toward the front door. Hart commanded us to stop. "No, gentlemen, come around here," he ordered. He led us around the house to the backyard, where a picnic table had been set for dinner. The grill had been lighted. Hart entered his kitchen through the back door. He returned a moment later with hot dogs, beans, and a few bottles of Coca-Cola. We ate the meal in silence, quickly. No formalities were observed. No toasts to the Academy or the Corps. No strained attempts at witty dinner conversation. No Mrs. Hart. A half hour after we arrived, he loaded us back into his car and returned us to Bancroft. Quite an etiquette lesson. I'm sure my disdainful contemporaries and disapproving instructors believed I would become a thoroughly disreputable upperclassman were I somehow to escape expulsion during my plebe year. Most of the time, my behavior only confirmed their low regard for me. For a moment, though, I came close to confounding their expectations. That moment began when I boarded the USS Hunt to begin my first-class cruise to Rio de Janeiro in June of 1957. The Hunt was an old destroyer. We spent a third of the cruise in the engineering plant, a grim place that seemed to the untrained eye a disgrace. The boilers blew scorching hot air on us while we spent long hours in misery learning the mysteries of the ship's mechanics. We spent another third of the cruise learning ship's navigation, and the last third on the bridge, learning how to command a ship at sea. The skipper was Lieutenant Commander Eugene Farrell, and I liked him a lot. I spent much of the cruise on the bridge, where the skipper would order me to take the control of the ship. There's a real mental challenge to running a ship of that size, but I truly enjoyed it. I made more than a few mistakes, and every time I screwed up, the skipper would explode, letting loose an impressive blast of profane derision. "Damn it, McCain, you useless bastard. Give up the con right now. Get the hell off my bridge. I mean it, God damn it. I won't have a worthless SOB at the helm of my ship. You've really screwed up this time, McCain. Get the hell out of here." As I began to skulk off the bridge, he would call me back. "Hold on a second. Come back here, mister. Get over here and take the con." And then he would begin, more calmly, to explain what I had done wrong and how the task was done properly. It was a wonderful time. I enjoyed the whole experience. As I detected in Farrell's outbursts, his sense that I showed some promise, I worked hard not to disappoint him. I was rarely off the bridge for much of the cruise. No other midshipman on the Hunt was so privileged. Inspired by the experience, I began to consider becoming an officer in the Surface Navy. I told Farrell of my intentions, and he seemed pleased. Fine gentleman that he is, he never rebuked me after I abandoned my briefly held aspirations for a destroyer command and returned to my original plan to become an aviator. Years later, while serving as a flight instructor in Meridian, Mississippi, I realized that I had adopted, unintentionally, Lieutenant Commander Farrell's idiosyncratic instruction technique. I took pride in the fact. When a Navy ship at sea needs to refuel or take on supplies and mail, it must come alongside and tie up to a refueling or replenishing ship while both vessels are underway. The maneuver is difficult to execute, even in the calmest seas. Most skippers attempt it cautiously, bringing their ship alongside the approaching vessel very slowly. But the most experienced ship handlers are bolder. They come alongside at two-thirds or full speed, much faster than the other ship. At precisely the right moment, they throw the engines in reverse and then ahead again at one-third speed. It's a spectacular thing to see when it's done right. An approximate image of the maneuver is a car traveling at 60 miles an hour as it approaches a parallel parking space. The driver slams on the brakes and pulls cleanly, without an inch to spare, into the spot. One beautiful afternoon, the flagship of the destroyer division to which a Hunt was attached, flying the ensign of the commanding admiral, approached us for the purpose of replenishing the Hunt's depleted stores. Lieutenant Commander Farrell gave me the con. Farrell told me to bring her up slowly, but offered no rebuke when I gave the order, all engines ahead, two-thirds. At precisely the right moment, I ordered all engines back full. A few moments later, again well-timed, I ordered all engines ahead, one-third. Thrillingly, and to my great relief, the Hunt slipped into place so gracefully that any observer would have thought the skipper himself, master ship handler that he was, had the con. Farrell was proud of me, and I was much indebted to him. He had given me his trust, and I had had the good fortune to avoid letting him down. After the two ships were tied up, he sent a message to the admiral. Midshipman McCain has the con. The impressed admiral sent a message to the superintendent of the Naval Academy, informing him of my accomplishment. Many years later, I learned that Farrell had been a student an admirer of my father's. Perhaps that explains his kindness toward me. Whatever the reason for the care he took with me, I was grateful for it. His confidence in me gave me more confidence in myself and greater assurance that I belonged at sea than I had ever experienced in the rigid, disapproving world of the Academy. Eugene Farrell was the man who taught me the craft of my father and grandfather.